Father Almighty, Lord, you sent your Son, and it's a real privilege to follow him. Lord, we live far, far away from where he lived, and so I pray that you can encourage us today to remember the things that he did and all that he saw. And I pray that when we think about the life that he lived and the life that he gave for us, we can be struck again with the love that you have, the fact that he died to save us. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I thought I'd sort of show you, I'm not going to show you everything that I saw, obviously, because that would take too long, and you'd probably want to throw things at me by the end of it. But I'm going to try and show you the highlights and stick to a biblical kind of theme for the most part. But I want to set the scene a bit as well. So we set off, this is while I was studying at Avondale in 2007. And we were lucky because when you go to study, if you can't pay straight up, the government provides a thing called fee help. And so the government pays for your tuition, and you pay them back over a certain amount of time. And what the college at Avondale realised they could do was create a course entitled Holy Lands Tour and put the cost of the tour up as tuition, which the government would then pay for. And because most of us are poor students, we couldn't afford to pay for ourselves. Obviously, we'd have to pay it back, and I'm still paying it back. But it was certainly a loophole worth using. It's been shut now. They realised how expensive it was going to be, I think. The cost for the tour alone was around about $7,000. And I did the short tour. I only did 3 weeks. I didn't go to Turkey or any of those places, which I would have loved to. But I know my limit from being away from my wife is about 3 weeks. After that, I go a bit crazy. So we set off at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you don't just fly all the way over because it's a long trip. So we decided to stop in Singapore on the way over. If you've got any questions while we go through this, feel free to ask. If you don't want to, ask me later. If you want to see the full 3,000 photos, then you're braver than I am, because about 500 of them are taken from a moving bus behind dirty glass with an inexperienced cameraman. So they're quite bad. But we went to Singapore, to the airport there. We were very excited. It's sort of unreal to think that we might actually be going to those places. And perhaps we were a little naive thinking that they would still look the way that they looked when Jesus was there. Singapore is a beautiful city if you've ever been there. Anyone been to Singapore before? Yeah, it's lovely. We went to Balestier Road, Seventh-day Adventist Church. We were there over the weekend. Pastor Mark Chan gave us a great sermon, and we surprised him by coming and eating all the food, but God worked a miracle on that day because we turned up with extra 30 people and yet the food lasted. You ever heard people doing that, when the food just seems to keep going and going? Yeah, it was a real miracle that day. And we went to the night zoo. They have a wonderful night zoo in Singapore with all these night animals and a little night show. We went to an orchid garden. That's just to prove I was actually there. They didn't just take these from someone else on the internet. That's an orchid. And we did some other things, which I won't go into. The tourist stuff, you know, I don't know why they wanted me to put this hat on, but I've always liked snakes. And we saw the fish line that Singapore gets its name from. And then we were off. Egypt was interesting. And I'm not dwelling on a lot of these places because I don't directly, I guess, refer to the Bible as such. But we did go to the Valley of the Kings, which is where the tombs of the great kings are. And it's amazing. I managed to pay a little bit extra and went down into the tomb of Tutankhamun himself and stood there in awe in this little room. It would have probably been about the size of this church, actually. But it's quite astonishing that you've heard about Tutankhamun all your life and just stand in the place that Carter discovered. And yeah, it was quite astonishing. Of course, we saw the pyramids. And I paid a bit extra, managed to go inside a pyramid and pick up a healthy case of claustrophobia while I was there. Because to get into it, you had to go down a tunnel that was about a metre high at about a 30-degree angle, and then go along and then walk up into the base of this thing. And you can feel the bricks on top of you when you're in there. It is oppressive and hot And I couldn't breathe, and I thought, gee, I need to get out of here now. I thought, how can everyone just be standing around breathing when there's no air? So maybe it was a little bit of a mild panic attack. So I ran out of there as quickly as I could and lay panting on the summer, in the summer sun and the desert heat outside. But it was worth going in there, it really was. And the Sphinx, of course. And we went to a few places like Karnak and Luxor, which were giant temples. And you can see the size of just some of the statues. This was the tomb of Hatshepsut, who was one of the most successful pharaohs. She actually happened to be female. And what's interesting is when you see the portraits of her, she's still got the beard on, the ceremonial beard of pharaonic power. She still wears it in her statues. So can you imagine if that was still the case, if women had to wear fake beards to show how powerful they were? That would be interesting. This is a guard who tried to make me give him money to take a photo of him. I said no, which I thought was rather brave, seeing as he has an automatic weapon under his arm. But I guess how else are they supposed to make some extra money on the side if you're a guard with a gun and nothing else to do? You can see the size of the, just how big they are, these kind of pillars just covered in their writing. It's quite amazing to see. I've got a lot more. Now, Petra is in the country of Jordan next to Israel. And the reason I guess we went there was to see something called the Seek, which is this giant chasm that wends its way through immeasurably high rock cliffs. They're quite astonishing. And you walk through this, and I don't know if you can see that, but it's just huge. You may even recognize this structure at the end. You've probably seen this before. This is known as the Treasury. That's me down the bottom there. And this is one of the things, the pyramids and this, when you see them, it's what you expect it to be. It is just phenomenal. And the reason I want to show you this is because this area in Jordan was actually where the Edomites lived. This is where Esau ended up moving out to and living. So the descendants of Esau lived in Edom and were the Edomites. You see up the top of the building there's a little urn, and all the Bedouin tribesmen in the area thought that that was a real urn full of gold. That's why they called it the Treasury. As you can see, they've been taking pot shots at it for a long time. It's just about worn away. You can see it's solid stone. There's no treasure in there to be had. But that's what they did, the Seek and the Treasury in Petra. There's also a structure a few hours away, we didn't get to that, where they say Aaron is buried, and they call this Aaron's tomb. We could see it from our hotel there in Amman. And it was quite, yeah, astonishing just to see this thing way over in the middle of nowhere that they suggest that that would be where Aaron is buried. Now, how much can you believe when people and tour guides in particular tell you things? That's something you've got to ask yourself continually when you're over there. You'll see more of that a little later. There it is, the kingdom of Edom and Petra in particular. So that's where it was, that's where we went to. Sinai, I've told you a little bit about already. You probably saw me talk about my climb up Mount Sinai, so I'm not going to tell you about that today. But when I came down from Mount Sinai, at the foot of Mount Sinai is St. Catherine's Monastery, which is infamous in Christian circles, especially because someone found just about an entire copy of the New Testament in Greek in the rubbish bin. That was older than any other copy they'd ever seen. It's a fascinating place. And monks have served there for a long time, for centuries. And they claim that this, for example, is the actual burning bush that that Moses encountered, which is odd, at the very least, to say that it was there. And they also say that happens to be Jacob's well in the same complex. Now, you kind of think, yeah, it's just for the tourists, really. That's what they say those things for. But it is a fascinating to visit nonetheless, because all the monks who ever worked there are still there. It's a little gruesome, I know, but there are rooms and rooms full of the bones of the monks who've served at that monastery. You can't get in there or anything, it's all locked up. But that's a lot, right? They even think that this may be where they designed their golden calf, but I think that might be more just an entrepreneurial local decided to sculpt something in the stone to try and get an extra few dollars out of the tourists. Can you see where they think it's a calf and the head and the feet? Yeah, who knows? Yeah. Greece, we went to Greece. And Greece, I guess, started getting a little more interesting, and there's a lot more that happened there biblically. And we went to Athens in particularly first. And Athens is an amazing town, because in the middle of it is this giant hill with the Acropolis on top. And it just dominates the landscape. Whenever you're in Athens, everywhere you go, you can see it over your shoulder out of the corner of your eye. And on top of that, of course, is the temple dedicated to Athena, after which the city is named. It was Athens that really opened my eyes to travel, because you get to the hotel and there's a little sign next to the toilet saying, please do not flush the toilet, this is not a flushable toilet. There's a little bin next to the toilet instead, and that's where you put your toilet paper. Because if you flush it, the sewage system is so old, the toilet paper will degrade it and destroy it. So, yeah, that's what happens when you live somewhere very, very old. And I'm kind of grateful to live somewhere quite new, comparatively. But it's an amazing city. There's a strong wind, so the whole city's pretty dirty. But you can just see this thing everywhere, the Parthenon in the Acropolis. And when you get up there, you realize how big it is. They're always doing extensive renovations on it, trying to fix it. But you can circle around and walk around the whole thing. There's a lot of buildings up there. It's not just this one building. There's a lot of buildings up there as you go around it. But they're huge. These kind of columns as well, you think they're just straight up and down, but they're not. They make them curved so that they actually look proper straight up and down from the base. They showed us when one had fallen over. It's quite astonishing. And the view from here is of this particular piece of rock. And this rock is interesting to us because that is known to us as Mars Hill, which we know about from the Bible, right? So you go down there and you have a look at this place, and I'll show you some other photos. The Bible calls it Areopagus, from Ares, Aero, the god of war, also known as Mars, so it's called Mars Hill or the Areopagus, and the Greek word pagos, which means big piece of rock. So it's a big piece of rock dedicated to Ares, the god of war. And interestingly enough, that's where the leadership used to meet and discuss their ideas. That's what it was for. And so here we are in Acts 17, 22 and 23. Paul then stood up in the meeting place of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands." And I guess I want to stress to you, because of the location, let me just flick back. This is where I'm standing there, that's literally the view down to Mars Hill. So Paul says this. He says that the Lord of God of heaven and earth does not live in temples built with human hands. He's saying that in the shadow of the temple to Athena, which is overshadowing everything. Think about the bravery and the courage of Paul as he stands in the middle of their leaders while this temple's right there, and he says, God doesn't dwell in anything that we can make with our hands. Pretty astonishing that he would do that. Yeah, it's when you realize that, that's amazing. This is what it's like when you stand next to it. We all climbed up on there and prayed and spent some time on this big piece of rock, the Areopagus. Right next to the Areopagus is this little walkway here. And what's even more interesting is that as you go down, it actually leads you to the Agora, which is the marketplace in Greece. That's what it was called, the Agora. And as you walk down it, all along next to it are these plinths. And this is where their gods would sit, on that very walkway. And so you know that Paul's walked on this road. That's what he's talking about. He says, I can see you're very religious. It's the road right next to the hill. I can see you're very religious, but I've even seen just there is a marker to the unknown God. And I'm here to tell you who that God is. Yeah. And these are the same, these are what stood. That's what stood when Paul was there. After that, we decided to go to Corinth. I guess we followed Paul around a bit. So this is the Corinthian Canal. It looks small, but when you see the size of the boat in it, it's actually huge. So that bridges over to Corinth. And we went to ancient Corinth. There's a modern Corinth and an ancient Corinth. And they're very protective of their landmarks in Greece. Very protective. While we were at Corinth, one of my friends bent down and picked up a rock from the ground. And all of a sudden, like two people were blowing whistles and pointing at him and running towards him. Put that down! Put that down! Because, I mean, you can imagine if every single tourist that went to Corinth picked up a little rock, right? It wouldn't take long and the whole city would be gone. So they're very protective. Same thing happened up the top at the Parthenon. It was quite amazing. So we went to ancient Corinth. So there's a kind of a broad overview of some of it. It's a really big town. Actually, it was a really big town, a bustling town. And there was I've got so many photos of the place. But, of course, they're mostly just photos of bricks and rocks. This is the sort of thing you can see, the details in the statues. Most of the statues are headless. They're doing a lot of restoration work there as well. There's one of the main roads through town. So that's the actual road they would have walked on. There's a little bit of a detail from one of the shops. This guy, can you guess what kind of shop he ran? Well, Corinth is next to the ocean, so yeah, he sold fishing stuff. You can actually see here are the shop fronts. See all these little individual walls? That's where the shops would be. You'd go shopping right there. They have a bit of canvas over the top, and that's where you'd go. But right in the middle of town is this edifice. And when you get close to that little sign there, it says that this heap of bricks is called the Bema. Now, if you look it up in your Bible, in Acts 18, this is where Paul stood in Corinth. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews of Corinth made a united attack on Paul and brought him to the place of judgment. In Greek, Bema. This man, they charged, is persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. So that's actually the Bema. They would stand up. The person judging would be up on top of that heap of bricks, looking down on the people below. That whole thing is the seat of judgment. Talk about trying to impress by size, right? Try to intimidate by height. It wasn't just a little seat that they sat on. It was this whole thing. Still there. So, Bema, judgment seat in the local agora. Because justice was done publicly, right? Everyone could see what happened. Something very interesting while we were there, we noticed this sign across the road from Corinth, and that was the ancient theatre, right? People liked their entertainment back then still. They wanted to go to the theatre. That doesn't mean it was a cinema. You couldn't go there and watch a movie, but it was where they did plays. It's where they did a lot of things. Now, you can't really see much because it's all been destroyed, but you can see the outline of it here. Like, it's enormous. These places are enormous. And you go to a lot of them over there. They've got these sort of, yeah, the built-up ramps, and someone could be standing on the bottom. You can actually hear them from up the top. That's where they would conduct their plays or play music. And right over on the edge of this is this little stone. Now, it's probably kind of difficult to see what it says. I don't know if anyone can make that out. But it says, Erastus Pro Ard SP Stravit. And I'll tell you what this is about. Acts 19:22. Erastus might sound familiar to you because he's in the Bible. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he, this is Paul, himself stayed in Asia for a while. Erastus is mentioned in Romans 16. Gaius, who is host to me and to the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, and our brother Quartus greet you. Now, Paul wrote the book of Romans from Corinth. That's where he composed it. So Erastus is actually the city treasurer. And he's a man of some means. If you're the city treasurer of Corinth, you've got some money. Which makes sense. Erastus, it says here, will remain at Corinth, and I left Trophimus, who was ill, at Miletus. That's in 2 Timothy. So there you go. There we find this stone actually laid by Erastus. And it says, if you want a translation, Erastus, in turn for his aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. Erastus was a man of some wealth, and he laid some of the pavement. You see, back in those days, and this aedileship, that's a kind of an office where you are an officer looking after the city. In those days, the city treasurers, the people who ran the town, were expected to provide some of their funds to support the town and to build the town. And so that's what they did. They did public works by building those kind of things. So this is what Erastus did. He was the treasurer of the city, but he used his own money to lay that. And that stone was discovered, I think, in 1922. Next we went to Caesarea Maritima. Am I going too fast for people? No? Good. There's two Caesareas, right? Caesarea Maritima and Caesarea Philippi. So the Maritima one is up here. Thanks. You're going to fill that up to me, are you? Thank you. So Maritima, there we are. Caesarea Maritima. So it's over on the ocean. And of course it's named after a Caesar. And we find about it in Acts 10. At Caesarea there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment. He and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. One day at about 3 in the afternoon, he had a vision. He distinctly saw an angel of God who came to him and said, Cornelius. So this is the Caesarea where Cornelius lived, where Peter went, where Cornelius was converted. Acts 23, we know that Paul was there as well. Then he called 2 of his centurions and ordered them, get ready, a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide horses for Paul so that he may be taken safely to govern. And we know that that was where Paul was kept in prison for a couple of years, and where he tried to give his testimony to Felix. Was Felix persuaded? No. He kind of was, wasn't he? But he wasn't interested. So here it is. This is Caesarea Maritima. There's a giant aqueduct there, which I haven't included photos of, but thinking about. And you'd be astonished how sitting up the top here, you can hear someone from talking in a normal voice down the bottom. The way the architecture is made is simply astonishing. Something very interesting was found in this town. About it, and it's as well. This is a replica of this stone. It's called the Violet Stone. It says on it. Thanks, Ron. This Augustus Tiberium Pontius Pilatus Praefectus Judea Fecit Dedicavit, which in English, to the divine Augusti Tiberium Pontius Pilate, Prefect of Judea, has dedicated this. Only existing record of Pontius Pilate. His people had said, no, Pontius Pilate, there's no record of him anywhere. He doesn't exist. And then they found this in the 60s. And it's funny, the reason they found it is because they were doing archaeology on the theatre. What had happened in the 4th century, someone had dug this rock up, well, this up that had laid down, and said, oh, we need to build something, we're going to use it somewhere else. And they used it in the theatre. So it was while they were doing archaeology on the theatre that they found this dedication stone from Pontius Pilate, who's the prefect of Judea. And at one stroke, everything that we know to be true in the Bible is proven archaeologically. And I guess that's really the amazing thing that I realise. You don't know about this stuff. You don't see this stuff. When you go over there, you can see it. The stone, you know, that's proof that he was alive at that time, because that stone's from that era. And that, it's obviously, he was the prefect of Judea, which our Bible tells us he was. And also, don't wear hats like that, unless you're on holidays overseas and you don't really care what you wear by this stage, because you're just exhausted and it's so hot. Believe it or not, they're shorts. Anyway, you don't want to look at me. Next we went to Nazareth. And we're getting closer. We're at least getting into Israel now, right? So we're getting closer to where we want to be, to walk with Jesus. And Nazareth sounds like somewhere Jesus went, because he's Jesus of Nazareth. And you can see where things are. Bethlehem is quite close to Jerusalem. There's Jericho. This is the path they would have had to come from Nazareth, simply because they wanted to avoid Samaria. Come on, click over. All right, there's a giant hill that Nazareth is kind of on, which is in the Bible. All the people in the synagogue, when Jesus speaks in Nazareth, what's their reaction? They were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built. That's it. And to throw him off the cliff. You can see how it's... Oh. Out of the hill. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. Yeah, that's modern day Nazareth. it's changed a little. I'm pretty sure they didn't have it back then. now, this is the Church of the Annunciation, because this is where Mary was. It was announced to her that she would be bearing Jesus Christ. You can see down through the church to what they say was somewhere that Mary might have lived. And just a note on this, all of these sites that you go to, who was the mother of Constantine. So she was the Christian who went around Israel and gathered where each of these sites were. I guess it's no surprise that Constantine ended up turning to Christianity with his mother in his ear, right? But they've built a church on top of things. And I've mentioned that before. They build a church everywhere. There's a church on top of every site that you ever want to go to. There's a church there. There's a church of the multiplication of loaves and fishes. In Galilee, there's a church simply for everything over there. We went to Galilee next. And Jesus was big in Galilee. It's when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he withdrew to Galilee, leaving Nazareth. He went and lived in Capernaum, which is by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali. This is Lake Galilee. There it is. It's not big. You can see clear across it on a good day. But it is windy. It is very windy. And you can tell that the wind that would have come up was ferocious. And you realize those stories about the disciples on Galilee in their boats through storms were well written, because that's exactly what happens. So you can see Tiberius by the side. We went on a boat and it actually showed us how they would have fished. They got out the nets and did some fishing for us. Boat, which was called Noah's Ark, so we felt kind of safe that it was going to survive. We stopped over at Capernaum. We went from Tiberias to Capernaum on the boat. And it's a big tourist area, the town of Jesus, they call it. It's a holy place, so no dog smoking, guns, or short clothing allowed. There's a lot of signs like that around the place. When you're over there, you can wear shorts as long as they're below the knee, which is why I have on such long shorts in all these photos. To cover up, you can't wear shorts or revealing clothing at all. In some places, the men need to cover their heads. We went to the tomb of David in Mount Zion, and that was very much like that. I'm not dogs, though. I guess I just don't want to clean up after them. But this is Capernaum. This is what it would have looked like. It's a darker brick. And just on the left there, you can rebuilding. Now, this is the synagogue at Capernaum. It's not the actual synagogue that Jesus stood in, but it is on the actual place, and it has been rebuilt with the same blocks that they would have used. So, is it the same synagogue? It fell down, so they rebuilt it. But this is where it was, and this is what it looked like. To Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. And it is amazing to stand in these places where Jesus did. You don't feel, you know, there's no kind of moment. But you realize Jesus stood in this place. He saw with his That's what I'm seeing now. He smelt the air coming off, you know. He lived, he walked in those places. And it's quite special to be there to realize that every story that we've read is more than just a story. It's an accurate description of a life, of a man's life who was more than a man who came to die for us. They've built this church on top of Peter's house at Capernaum. That's where Peter lived. So when you look down underneath, you can see they think this is probably Peter's house. Just to give you a sort of a hint, that's what it looks like underneath the church. So you can see there's a central room here and surrounding rooms around it. Is it really Peter's house? Well, maybe. It could be. But that's what the houses at least would have looked like. That's what Peter would have house. You can see the mosaics, the tiling of it. It was quite exquisite. It wasn't simple living by any means. Just because we're seeing a pile of broken down rocks now doesn't mean it wasn't beautiful. A millstone, obviously, at Capernaum, which Jesus would have been looking at when he said, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So he's saying that while standing next to the Sea of Galilee, next to a millstone. So when we read these things, they're not ever in a vacuum. He's saying these things while in a place and looking at things around him. I think it's really important to remember that. Next, we went to Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus said this. He asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Caesarea Philippi was actually a place where there was an ancient cave dedicated to pagan gods. And so it's in that cave that's asked this question. Because this is where people came to worship them. He said, who do you say I am? Do you know what I mean? This is important. He doesn't just ask these questions randomly, but he asks them in the environment that he's in. It's at the headwaters of the waters that lead down to the Lake Galilee. And quite a pretty place. Of course, the lake feeds into the Jordan River, and Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan, and when he came out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit descending upon him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, thou art my beloved Son, with thee I am well pleased. Mark 1, 9-11. There's the Jordan River. Well, there's the portion of it that we stopped anyway. And I may have mentioned before that because Israel's reforesting, they're asking for trees from a lot of countries, including Australia. What did we send them? Gum trees. Which is why it looks like the Murray, if you're thinking it looks familiar. It does, doesn't it? I swear I've been to that place in Mildura. But there's a few centres you can go to. They're like baptismal centres that run. That's what they do. They run baptisms for you. And we had a couple of people who went to Israel specifically to get baptised in the Jordan where Jesus was. That's pretty amazing to do. The water is very green, isn't it? There you go. That's where we were. We went to Qumran, which... Have I ever told you how many rocks there are in Israel? Have I mentioned that before? This is what the countryside is like. Big rocks and little rocks and smaller rocks and dirt. That's why they're reforesting. Israel is like this. It's very hot, very dry. There's caves everywhere that you go, and you can see these caves are quite large when you compare the size of the people. But these sort of caves that David would have hid in, they're everywhere in these little mountains here. Qumran is a little community of believers who have dedicated to the Word of God. And it's from this little community that were so good at writing out the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because what happened is they hid all of their scrolls, all of their precious scriptures away in one of these caves. And, you can see that was only found in 1947, these Dead Sea Scrolls. And they're amazing, obviously, because of the age of them. They're much older. But also, accurate they are compared to what we hold today. It gives us reassurance that what we read is what Jesus read. So they've got, say, the entire book of Isaiah from the time of Jesus, and it's exactly, pretty much word for word. There's a couple of words that are off, and that's kind of amazing when you think about it, the fact that it's the same thing that Jesus read. It's like playing Chinese whispers with a book the size of Isaiah across 2,000 years and getting it exactly right. And for me, that speaks to the fact that, although it doesn't really worry me, there's a few odd words, because the message that comes through is what God wants us to hear. And that's, I couldn't do that. I think that's amazing. I think God looks after his word. What they were discovered in the Dead Sea Scroll. And obviously, yeah, there's... that was just a replica. And there's the Dead Sea right next to this community, and that's why Dead Sea Scrolls. The dry, salty air helped protect those scrolls, and they lasted for a long time. We did go into the Dead Sea, by the way. That's the little resort that's right next to it. And, you know, you've heard about the Dead Sea that you can just float in. Well, that's absolutely true, and it's horrendous. The last place on the planet Earth, and well, we believe that this is where Sodom and Gomorrah once stood, right? And not any longer. It's the lowest place on Earth. And all that sulfur and all that kind of gunk is... I don't know if you've ever, like... It's like salt in it. That's what it's like. But every little bit of open scratch, or you scratch yourself anywhere like that, you get in that water... starts burning like fire. Yeah, it is quite astonishingly bad. But people go there and cover themselves with the mud because they believe it's good for you. Because anything that smells that bad has got to be good for you, I think. So, I won't show you any photos of that. And we drove past quite a few of these, which are the little townships that the Bedouin tribes would build up. They wouldn't always be in it because they would travel around. And when they came back to that region, that's where they would set up camp. Yeah, the Bedouins were everywhere still. We went to Bethlehem, which was interesting because Israel has a few zones that are classified as Palestinian controlled, and Bethlehem happens to be in one. And so our Israeli tour guide stopped. He said, all right, everyone off the bus, and we all got off the bus, and we crossed over to another bus that came from the Palestinian side. So you're on this side of the wall, you're in, I guess, Israeli-controlled territory. And you can see here behind the barbed wire, it says, peace be with you, next to the tower that has guns in it. So Israel Ministry of Tourism, and there's a giant concrete wall. You're kind of funny. So you cross over to the other side, and you see graffiti like this from the Palestinians. To exist is to resist. And you realize that you're in a disputed territory and that maybe it's not quite as safe here as it is in Australia. They keep tourists pretty safe because if tourists stop coming, then everyone loses their livelihood. But you still get a little bit nervous. And the tour guide, who's a Christian Palestinian, he was so emphatic. He said, please go home and tell people to visit. Tell them it's safe to come. Because you think, oh, it's a bit dangerous over there, but, and you read the travel advisory warnings that says don't go near here and don't go near there. And yeah, there are some dangers. The Gaza Strip, you wouldn't go for a tour down there. But at the same time, when the Cronulla riots happened in Sydney, there was a travel advisory for people coming from overseas not to go near Sydney. And that's kind of crazy. I've lived in Sydney for years. I never saw, you know, it's perfectly safe. And so there are plenty of safe areas in Israel as well, mainly because they've got an enormous military backed by the US. So, but there is this feeling of resentment because they've locked off access to Jerusalem for a lot of Arabs who worked in it, so they couldn't get anything. So you drive through modern-day Bethlehem, there it is. And of course it's mainly Palestinians who live there, so there's a lot of... There's still some churches and there's Christians there. And you come to the church, which is important for so many religions, right? It's hugely important. And so you enter in through the door and you find yourself, most of the churches are run by like the Catholic Church and Jew, Coptic Church, and so you'll see all these kind of lamps that the Coptic Church puts up everywhere. There's a hole in the floor because they're doing archaeology. And this is the kind of, that's what their altar looks like at the front. It's just festooned with decorations and gold and icons and idols, of course. That's what they've got. And then back around this altar, there's a little stairway down here. I'll see if this is if this video works, because it's simply phenomenal how many people are jammed into this little room, which is apparently the site where Jesus was born. So you're lined up there and you're kind of forcing your way down and people are taking photos. And it takes a long time. There are little icons everywhere. And then you get down and it's just as bad inside and there's people everywhere. Because they say this was where they were born. I tell you that it was most likely in a cave, that animals were usually kept in small caves at the side of hills, rather than any kind of dinky wooden structure that was known as a barn. And they're all taking photos of themselves in front of this star that's set in the marble floor, which apparently heralds the spot where Jesus was born. There it is. You can see someone else next to me already taking a photo. I don't know how they're going to feel with my hand in it, but there it is. If there's any grace bestowed upon me by touching a marble floor, I've got it. Next to Bethlehem, of course, is Jerusalem. And you know you're in Jerusalem because you see guys like this walking around with the hair. And I guess he's a violin student. You see markings that mark out how far people are allowed to walk on the Sabbath. They've got these all around the wires around the city. So for the Orthodox Jews who are only allowed to travel a certain distance before they have some food or a rest, there's these little ribbons everywhere so they know how far they can walk. Jerusalem is very much for the ultra-religious and Orthodox Jews. Other cities like Tel Aviv are much more Western. And when we went to one of them, it was just astonishing because we went out at 11 p.m. and all the shops were open still. It's nice and cool, right? And so they all the keep it open all night. But yeah, there's the wall going up. They're still putting up walls. And the first place you arrive is, of course, on the Mount of Olives, which is kind of strange. You find it at Jerusalem and you get off and you're on the Mount of Olives. You go from sitting in this bus to standing in this place that was one of Jesus' favourites to go with his disciples. And of course, as you sit on the Mount of Olives, you realise what he was looking at. You realise what Jesus was sitting there looking at, right? What was here was the temple, right? He sat there looking at that temple. When he went to the Mount of Olives, that was the view. The temple of his Father. And that's amazing. It's not just some nice, pretty hill that he went to. He went there very deliberately, didn't he, to see that. Of course, now the Dome of the Rock's there. And it's a very political situation. Jesus went out, as usual, to the Mount of Olives and his disciples followed him. It was his habit. It was his custom. That's where he went. That's where he liked to go, to the Mount of Olives. Well, we didn't go visit the Dome of the Rock, obviously. Down the side, it's a cemetery. Right on the Mount of Olives, that's mostly what covers it now, are graves. And you can probably see some of the rocks, because there's so many, right? People are buried there. It's so windy, they can't leave flowers. The flowers get blown away. So visit a relative, you leave a rock on their grave. Yeah. And of course, just down the right in front of here is the Kedron Valley. That's actually the Kedron Valley right there. You think of this massive thing, but it's not that far. It's quite walkable, and that's what we did. We walked down to this sanctuary, the Dominus Flevit. There's churches everywhere, and they because this is where the bush is that grows those thorns that they believe made the crown of thorns that Jesus wore. That's my hand, of course. You can see how long those thorns actually are. Like, they're massive. They're a good couple of inches long. And they felt it. And towards the valley, came across the Hortus Gethsemane. which is, of course, the Garden of Gethsemane, right? And it's still there. These olive trees, they believe, Gethsemane means olive press. They believe there was a business there that made olive oil. That's the Mount of Olives because the trees grew there. And so these trees, olive trees live for an extraordinarily long time. And it's certainly possible that these trees were standing when Jesus was in this garden. They won't let you in there to touch it. It's guarded by a gate. But you can see how ancient some of these trees are. Some of them are even propped up by a little wall of bricks there. Next to the Garden of Gethsemane is a church, the Church of All Nations. Church on this spot because they believe they found the place where Jesus prayed to his Father. It must be this particular piece of rock. And so that's right where the altar is. You can see that they worship on the place where they believe Jesus prayed to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane. I told you they put a church on top of everything, didn't I? Next, the Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. Now, it's kind of strange that the place where Peter would deny Christ three times is being cherished, and they've built a church on top of that as well. Now, of course, you know where Jesus denied? Where was Jesus when he denied Christ three times? He was in the courtyard at the house of Caiaphas. And this is where it is, Gallicantu. This is where Caiaphas lived. The church here is built, and it's been around for so long. These are actually marks in the wall made by the Crusaders. And there are just thousands of crosses made by the actual Crusaders who came through. They're just phenomenal to see, history. And there's a little stone footpath down to underneath what they believe was underneath Caiaphas. Was this dungeon, this room. There's this, and this is where they believe Jesus was held. And they took him to see Caiaphas, this place. This little rock cell carved out of the stone. So that's why they built a church on top of it. Once you get further inside Jerusalem, it's hard to recognize, perhaps, but these are actually the pools of Bethesda. Those covered pools where the water was stirred occasionally by the angels and people would rush to get in so they could be healed. This is them. Well, it was them, but now the water is gone. And you can't quite see it, but there are some deep pool areas. You can see where it would have been covered, and it covers a big area too. There's in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate, a pool, and we came in via the Sheep Gate, and there right in front of you are those pools, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. So there you go, that's it, the pools of Bethesda. They're still all there. And as you walk through Jerusalem, you'll see things like this. There's a path through Jerusalem called the Via Dolorosa, which is the path that they say Jesus walked himself. And the Catholics mark the stations of the cross that they worship along. Of course, you'll see the western wall of the temple, and that's where the Jews go to worship. This is actually on a Saturday night. It's not the Friday night. Friday night's the big night. You're not allowed to take photos then, but we came back Saturday night to take some photos. And you can see they've got all of their Bibles here, or their Torahs, I should say, and they're praying up against the wall. That's where they go to pray. You know why they pray here? Because, I don't know if you know this, but Jews believe that this, where this is built, right, Mount Moriah, they believe this is where God created Adam and Eve, this place. They believe this is where Abraham brought his son to sacrifice him. They believe that this place is a holy place. And they believe that because the priest is only there, they're going to get to the place, as close to the place as they can, where the Spirit of God has been most strongly. And, of course, they can't go over there because the rest of it's a Muslim enclave. But here is the top of the wall. They're doing excavations way underneath. You can go in through this little door and go down. Oh, that's the women's section over there, by the way. That's where they're in the separate area that Herod put in. They're just enormous. They're huge. The western wall is the very top of an actual wall that went around the sanctuary. And then you walk through the streets of Jerusalem and they're kind of crowded and they've got, amazing shops everywhere and they smell strange. And you come to the Church of the Flagellation. And they scourged. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. And it starts coming home to you that you're standing in a place where Jesus suffered. That you're standing in a place where other men caused him immense pain. And they've got a church added to it, the Church of the Flagellation. Next to it is the Church of the Condemnation and Imposition of the Cross. And you realize that this happened right here. There's churches all through Jerusalem, of course, but you go to churches, the Church of the Flagellation, and you see the actual Roman road that was running through Jerusalem at that time. So this, without a doubt, was the road that Jesus himself walked on. And to stand there knowing that his blood fell on that road, for me, as he walked along it, is kind of humbling, to be honest, to stand there and realize that this is what he saw. And then you get to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the end of the walk, and this is a church that is built supposedly over one site that could be the site of Jesus' death. And you look up towards the top, it's supposedly built over the hill of Golgotha, and when you go up the stairs up there, up the stairs, you find this piece of rock under a piece of glass. And they say to you, we think that's Golgotha. It's a huge, huge church, and it's just astonishing. To the left is a cupola, which contains in here what they think was where the tomb of Jesus was. So they've actually got a building over where they think the tomb was, inside the church. So it's absolutely massive. I don't know if you can get a sense of that. And you can go inside, and there's not much in there to see, but they say this is possibly where the tomb of Jesus was, and you can light a votive candle of worship if you wish. But just opposite the church, through the Damascus Gate, is a little walkway up to this other possible place, the Garden Tomb. And you walk up there and you think, okay, is this just another tourist trap? And then, that's my friend Peter who came with me. And then you see this place and there's the bus stop right there. But there in the hill, I don't know if you can see something that looks like the suggestion of a skull. Can you see that? The deep-set eyes? Maybe this is the place. It is right outside the city gates, just like the Bible says. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle. And it wasn't at some far-off place that they took Jesus. It wasn't at some romantic painted hill that you see in all the artwork. They dragged him outside the city gates like a common criminal and nailed him to a cross to bleed and die. It's easy to try and see the artwork and romanticize it. And although I love that Jesus died for us, that is amazing what he did. It was a brutal and ugly death. But right next to that hill are these. This is why they think maybe there's something to it. It's a tomb. And this is how the tombs were, right? There's a little window at the top and a doorway that they would roll a stone in front of. And they would usually let people lay there for a year until all the flesh was gone, and they would go and collect the bones and put it in a box called an ossuary. And you can see there's, taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid, because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. And it's entirely possible that this is the place where Jesus lay. It's a brand new tomb. It's right next to this hill that looks like a skull. You can see there's a little track built in front of it. That was the track that kept the stone in place when they rolled this massive stone in front of the doorway. And they've got these stones over there. You try and move them, they're taller than me. They are absolutely huge. It takes more than one person to move them. But here's the thing. Inside the tomb, Eliana said, "Is that a stone bed?" Oh, yeah. It's exactly what it is. But it's empty. Jesus didn't stay in the tomb very long. And I guess that's what really hit me when I stood there. John 20, verse 1 says, "Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary of Magdala went to the tomb and saw the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, 'They have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him.' So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb, both are running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as a burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed." What did he see? He saw an empty tomb. He saw the linen that had just been wrapped around Jesus cast aside and unneeded. The tomb is empty still. Jesus really lived and breathed and walked in those places that I've walked in. He bled on those places that I've stood on, and he died in that place for me and for you. I know not everyone will get a chance to go to Jerusalem, but I just wanted to share some of what I saw there to show you these places are real, true, and that the tomb is still empty today.